So we need to intervene and stop those inconsistencies from happening. And at the core, that's kind of what Huckleberry does. We believe that everybody has a right to a safe, healthy, just, and educated life.
That was Doug Stiles, CEO and Executive Director of Huckleberry Youth. I'm Jeff, and this is Storied San Francisco, a podcast all about the artists, activists, and small businesses that make this city unlike any other. This is part two of our episode on Huckleberry Youth. In this podcast, we pick up where we left off in part one, with Doug sharing the story of how he came to work at Huckleberry. Doug and Denise talk about the history of Huckleberry, as well as the nonprofit's vision and what they're up to today. Here's the conclusion of my conversation with Doug Stiles and Denise Coleman of Huckleberry Youth.
Oh, we met before that, actually. I forgot. Oh, so the agency, this is serendipity.
Sure.
Our agency, and so Denise was already at Huckleberry. She can talk about that. Our agencies had a meeting to talk about, are there ways that we could collaborate together across county? There was discussion about maybe merging or at least thinking about what some form of that would look like. Mm-hmm. And that none of that worked, so it kind of went away. But that was kind of my thinking about, oh, maybe there's this agency still up there. Mm-hmm. The executive director who'd been there a while, Bruce Fisher, said, you know, he announced his retirement.
Okay.
For the fifth time.
I was going to say, the first time I heard it wasn't the time that he left. So a couple of years later, then I was seriously looking for an executive position, was applying a bunch of places. And he then said, now I'm actually retiring, and applied, was hired, and have been at Huckleberry Youth Programs for almost 10 years now.
And so 2014.
Yes,
okay. Started in 2014.
Okay.
And you, do you live in the city?
I've lived in the city now 25 years.
Oh, kind of me too.
Yeah.
We overlap.
This time.
Okay, so you came on 10 years ago, so we've got you now at Huckleberry. Who wants to talk about Huckleberry before your time?
The real history is fascinating. And I was here when it was happening. I had no idea because I was 2 years old.
Right.
But in 1967, and this is documented in Season of the Witch, as you had talked about, Talbot's book. In 1967, Summer of Love, young people from all over the world coming to San Francisco to become enlightened, find themselves,
try drugs,
listen to the music, and unfortunately many young people found themselves on the street in doorways disconnected. Mm-hmm. And the community got together, the San Francisco Foundation, Glide Church, a couple other community partners came together and said, this is not okay, let's do something about it. And with a little bit of seed funding, created a three-month project. They got a house donated and said, let's get these youth off the street.
Got a house donated. Can we just sidebar that real fast? But I think
this is way back, and you know.
And I think the point is, whoever did this donating saw the value of what.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
So this project was started to work with youth, with the primary goal of reconnecting them with their families, knowing that most people are having communication or behavioral challenges in their family. That's why they run away. They're not usually running to something. They're running away from something. Mm-hmm. And we know nowadays, most young people end up reconnecting with their families at some time in their life, whatever the situation is that they left it. It could be horrific, and there's still family, and there's still an attempt to connect.
Right, there's no guarantee, but a lot of times those
at some
connections point, can be reestablished and everyone benefits.
Exactly. So why not do that up front at the very beginning?
Right.
So the goal of Huckleberry House at the beginning and still today is let's get the families together. Let's start talking. Let's figure out what some of the main issues are and resolve those or work on those so that there's stronger communication between the youth and their family. And let's get them back home rather than into an institution. Mm. Into the serial homelessness, into couch surfing, if it's safe, let's say that too.
Sure.
We don't want anyone going back to a harmful situation, but if it's safe, let's, that connection's always going to be there. Let's work on it right now.
Quick aside, I think what I'm hearing in the approach of the groups that came together to form Huckleberry House was seeing, unhoused people and feeling compassion, feeling empathy, and trying to do something. I often, like when I hear people in day-to-day life, I mean, it's not exactly party talk, but it does come up sometimes. And like, I always, especially if it's someone I don't know, I try to gauge their approach to the issue. Are they talking about blight? Mm-hmm. Or are they talking about there's an issue here, there's a human issue here, and can we do something? So I just wanted to throw that out. And I think it's an important distinction. There are those who for whom it is an eyesore.
Yes.
I'll say this.
Yes,
please.
Because I have a lot to say about it, but I'll just say this a little bit. It is troubling when you see anybody unhoused on the street.
Right.
That should trouble anybody.
Right.
When you see a minor or a young person, that should be even more. Nobody is born to be a criminal. Nobody is born to be in conflict with their family, yet those things happen. Nobody has the personality of, you know, and if we start with that as a, no, this person is in a situation, they may have all the skills to get out of it and the situation is unbearable, or they may not have the skills to get out of a situation. That
right.
In both of those, it's the broader system and their skills that are not interfacing together. Mm. And if we can bring those things together, we can change the broader system that's impinging on them, and we can build some skills internally for them. They're going to be much more successful in whatever, you know, happens in the future.
Yeah. All those things you just said, I was like, well, one of them also is just, you know, confidence, belonging,
belonging.
Purpose. And I'm sure those are totally woven into
belonging
the fabric of what you guys do.
Yeah. Belonging is central to being human.
Right.
And if you think of adolescence, it is the critical component of that stage. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I come from the perspective of brothers and cousins and stuff. So like I always had that and friends and, you know, growing up in the '80s and stuff. Like it was,
Everybody had five or six kids.
Yeah. You can take it for granted. If it's all, you know, you take it for granted, but like,
well, I was going to end on the 67 story of the beginning, the origins of Huckleberry, if that's what,
the donated house.
Well, yes. Yes.
I got myself on a tangent. Like what?
It was probably more complex than that. But anyway, there was a house.
The tax write-off or something, let's say.
So at that time in 67, being a runaway was against the law. It was a status offense, meaning if you're a minor and you do it, you get arrested. If you're an adult and you do it. But, you know, not a problem. So if you're a minor and you run away, it's against the law and you get arrested and you get locked up. So if you're a program and you have a runaway in your house, then you are aiding and abetting the delinquency of a minor. So it is also illegal to take in runaways into a shelter in that time. So this is all revolutionary. Huckleberry was the first to kind of think through, how do we deal with this?
In the nation? And
in the nation, yes.
Oh, wow.
The first runaway shelter for minors in the nation. Yes.
Okay.
So the way to get around it was, let's contact the parents and say, we've got your kid here. Is it okay if he stays? And if the parents say yes, then we have authorization to work with them. So that was the standard to get around that. one of the challenges came up when a youth came in, and it's not clear if that call didn't get made or what happened, but a parent complained and said, I don't know what my kid's doing there. They complained to the right people. The police came in and raided Huckleberry House in October of 67, arrested all the young people that were there, arrested...
Even the ones that were there,
yes.
I guess, legally.
Yes, everybody got locked up. So the staff all was locked up, too, for contributing to the delinquency of a minor.
It's a dragnet.
Yes.
Is that what they call that?
Yes, yeah. And if you read Season of the Witch, there's personalities in there who were engaged in politics who are also playing into this. Mm. Talking about blight, as you were talking about, there's mm-hmm. people that didn't feel like this was an appropriate way to work with mm-hmm. young people, mm-hmm. et cetera. Mm-hmm. Willie Brown, the mayor of San Francisco, former Speaker of the Assembly, became the attorney for Huckleberry, got the charges released.
Lying on his resume.
Yeah,
he's that's awesome though. Yeah, I love that. Yes. I love that. Was he like a young attorney?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, from Texas too. Yeah.
Yep,
just like me.
And in February of 67, all the charges were dropped. The place opened back up, and 55 years later, we're still here.
Feb 68.
Did I say 68? What'd I say?
You said the raid happened in October 67.
Yeah, 67. So 68 is when.
Feb 68. Yeah.
So
okay.
Open back up then.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
And he's still good friends with us.
Yeah.
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 Wow.
So that's the origin story. A lot has happened in all that time.
Sure. Yeah. Walk us through the next 45 years.
But if people remember.
55, sorry.
The 60s were. It's easy to think back and say, oh, love and peace. And no, there was like crackdown, arrests. It was. The hate was not a friendly neighborhood in 67.
It was a time
really
of
challenging.
Change, I think, more than anything, change, right? Yeah. Sort of the. The end of the post World War era, but then getting right into gay liberation, women's lib, anti-war. Like, there's just so much going on. Assassinations all over the place. But I love that amid all this, Huckleberry found. Okay, well, do you want to take us through, kind of half joking, of the next 55 years of like maybe some of the highlights?
I didn't know a lot about the hype program, but it was our HIV program.
Okay. So this would be the 80s.
Yes. Yes. And it was a pretty robust program. There were a lot of TAs and young adults, you know, that were concerned or that were contracting. Mm-hmm. And so we had counseling. We had testing, not physical medications there, but access to the meds that people would need.
We had like maybe at the free clinic?
We had a health clinic.
Was the free clinic? Was not y'all's.
No.
But
the Haight-Ashbury free
close
clinic.
Close in the same, neighborhood.
In the same exact neighborhood.
Yeah.
We're on
I think they're in the book too.
Yeah. And so, you know, it was a huge need. Mm-hmm. So it was, I mean, that's Huckleberry's, I guess, kind of mantra, right? Wherever there's a need, you know, if we can kind of fill that need, then we'll fit in there and we'll fill it.
Yeah.
And so that's the Cold Street Clinic. And we actually had a clinic in Huckleberry House for the kids.
Okay.
When Huckleberry House started.
In the basement.
In the basement.
like a general clinic or specifically for HIV?
No, this was a general clinic. As kids, they came in.
Right.
You know, they were living on the streets.
Right. So, you need a doctor.
They needed somebody to, kind of check them out.
Yeah.
We had a staff member at Huckleberry House who is just barely past his teens, who was HIV positive in the late 80s, early 90s, Danny Keenan.
Okay.
And he said, I don't think it's good to have older people talking to kids. They're not going to listen to you. We need to have kids talking to kids. We need young people. And started to promote, how do we have a peer-to-peer conversation around safe sex and all the things that were coming out. And so Huckleberry then applied for a CDC grant, and we were the first to receive a CDC grant for youth HIV AIDS education in the country.
And a lot of feathers in your cap.
Thanks to Danny Keenan.
I mean, it's,
we were at the forefront of really getting people education and prevention work around early stages in the HIV AIDS.
Amazing. I'm thinking of other sort of eras in San Francisco. And one thing, like right before my arrival, was like the first sort of .com. Did any of those things change? Or, I mean, you see rise, you know, the number of unhoused folks mm-hmm. fluctuates mm-hmm. from time to yeah. time. You know, has Huckleberry had to adjust or respond to things like that over the years?
Well, yeah, what I would say that over the years, when Huckleberry House started in 67, there were young people from literally all over the world coming. Currently, and I would say maybe in the 80s and 90s, most of the young people that we work with through Huckleberry House are local people from the Bay Area. Mm. And we started to branch out with the clinic. We started to look at how do we provide not just HIV AIDS education, but sex education. We mm-hmm. provide a lot of in the schools now in San Francisco and Marin. Mm-hmm. We actually had another home in Marin that we started mm-hmm. in the 70s that was very much like Huckleberry House. And what's happened over the years is that the need for those has fluctuated.
Yeah.
And unfortunately in the 2000s, was it? I guess before I came on.
We
closed the Nine Gruff Lane was the name of it. That's where it was in San Anselmo. Mm-hmm. We had to close that facility mm-hmm. because of utilization and funding needs. Mm. I got to tell you, not a year goes by where I don't get four or five requests. Sure. Where is that? Why isn't this right. still open? Yeah. But at the time, that was the .com bust, mm-hmm. and there just wasn't the support financially to keep something like that open.
The bust, when it became impossible to get a job.
Yes.
And right. impossible, and without a job, you yeah. can't. It's yeah. hard.
Yeah.
It's hard with a job, let's be real.
Yeah.
Yes, so, it is. Especially yeah. if you live in the Bay.
Yeah. Doug, you mentioned that the current Huckleberry House is not in that original, was it Broderick?
Yes.
Location. Broderick, yeah. What's the story of that move, and what can you tell us about the house today?
There have been various facilities for not just runaways, but other things, the other issues that were coming up with young people. Mm-hmm. There's Sojourner House. There's multiple programs across San Francisco that happen.
Okay.
And those have come and gone. They are no longer around. But through all of that, the runaway shelter for Huckleberry House has remained. In the 80s, some very thoughtful and for, you know, thinking ahead, board members decided we should get together and actually purchase a building rather than moving around every couple of years.
Because and so that's means. What I think was the real thing, yeah. instead of renting, to find a building that we could get rooted in.
And you had City Hall helping you, or it was their idea, or?
I don't know. I don't think City Hall helped.
Oh, why did I say? Oh, you meant board members.
Board members, board of supervisors.
Scratch that. Yeah. Members, I'm on fire today, y'all.
Members of the board of directors. Yes.
Yeah.
And raise the funds, purchase the building, which we are now in currently.
Two things. Like I mentioned earlier, I live just up Geary. And so I was aware of the office up Geary. Yeah. And I actually was getting off the bus at Geary Masonic.
Saw the fire.
That day. And I was like, oh, wow. Yeah. I didn't know it was y'all. Well, it was next door, technically,
yeah,
right?
Yes,
but
yes.
Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, the
I
fire.
Think that was like
were you
your
there
first that? Year, right?
No.
What?
No.
God, you've been there about maybe it was three like, or 4 years, right?
A couple years, yeah.
Either 18 or 19.
Yeah. That was, I wasn't five, 6 years. There, oh, yeah. but most of the CARC staff was there, and the phone calls, oh, my word. Yeah. Mm.
So we're located at Geary and Parker for 35 years or so.
This is the building. Like the office, this administrative
office.
Stuff, yeah.
We had some programming there, administrative office, and that day we were
Since when, sorry?
We were there 35 years.
Oh, wow. Okay, so most of the existence.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
And at that day, there was a large training. We had a lot of staff in the building. Mm. Verizon had hired a contractor who was digging some lines for them, and in front of the building hit a gas main, and it sparked and shut up a plume of
fire.
The
rest is history.
It was a good 2 hours that the plume was shooting up. So
I'm not remembering the time of day. Like, was Hong Kong Lounge...
Oh, it's midday.
Were they open?
Was
yes.
There were people inside the restaurant.
Yes.
Yes.
Eating.
Yes.
And you guys were in your office working.
Yes.
Just like like you said.
Yes.
Kind of busy.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. I was not there. I was at a meeting across town, and as I was walking out of the meeting, got the call saying, "You better get over here."
The call that no one wants. No. Yeah. One of those calls. Yeah. Yeah.
So I got over here without getting a speeding ticket, and it for 2+ hours there was a plume of fire. Firefighters
pouring water
on our building that we were in just to make sure it didn't spread, and unfortunately it did spread a little bit. So a bit of the roof burned, but mostly there's just water damage for 2 hours of hoses there.
Yikes.
So there's no way we could stay in that building.
Yeah.
We had a lot of memorabilia in the building. We saved as much as we could. I mean, we have letters from Harvey Milk, Dianne Feinstein, when she was mayor back in the 70s. We've got, there was a lot of stuff. Most of it we were able to salvage.
Oh, that's great.
A lot of our administrative stuff in the basement, however, was soaked and ruined. So those were all ruined. And
were you in the office that day, too?
I wasn't.
Okay.
I was at one of our satellite offices over on the golf. I think it was on golf. Yeah. But a bunch of the staff was over here and everyone was calling.
At the
frantic.
Training.
Crying.
Yeah. It's
just totally traumatized.
Trauma.
Yeah. 100%. And it took the staff a really long time. I mean, we worked with them over months and months and months because they just.
So now y'all are taking care of your own.
Yeah.
Right? That's wow.
Yeah.
And then is this the new iteration?
We're still temporary. So that happened in 2019.
19, okay.
February. Curiously, a year after that, we went into lockdown for COVID. So we had some temporary placement that we're clear was not going to be permanent. And we were starting to look for a new place for the administrative offices when COVID happened and we locked down. So we have where we are currently on Gary is a very small place, but it houses all of our storage and then some administrative stuff. We would like to have something bigger, but we kind of thought, oh, COVID, that's going to be, you know, I was thinking a year. Sure. People were saying, you know, a couple of months. I was like, no, this will be a year. Well, three years
the first up on? The first stay at home was 2 weeks.
Yes.
Which I'm like, that's cute.
Yes.
No.
No, I knew.
Oh. Yeah.
I was ready. Like, that's just to get you used to it.
That was horrible. COVID was, to me, the worst thing that could have happened to our kids, our staff,
ask,
everybody.
Were they just able to quarantine at the house then?
If they needed to.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. So the house stayed open. And
to new folks?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So we the rest of our programs all went remote. They continue to operate. We learned very quickly how to use Zoom and Meets and all of those things.
Yeah.
Which we were doing a little bit before, but not a lot.
Right.
Interestingly, the 2 years before the pandemic, we had moved all of our records online. So we were able to move remote pretty quickly with all the administrative stuff because we had already had done that. That was just
was that because
lucky
of the fire?
Timing.
Because of the fire or?
Before the fire.
Even before the fire.
We were starting to, and then definitely because of the fire, then we just went completely online for all of our records and everything were all digitized and moved online.
Mm-hmm. The other topic I wanted to ask about specific to Huckleberry is, you know, I was talking about sort of, I guess, societal trends or economic trends or things like that. Drugs vis-a-vis your programs. Like, do you have programs for people who either come in addicted or...
I mean, when that is an issue for the kids, the program that I kind of oversaw was our justice program. Mm-hmm. CARC is our justice program, and it's the community, the acronym is Community Assessment and Resource Center.
Okay.
And I was started in 1998 by Delancey Street Foundation.
Okay.
And they quickly learned that it was impossible for them to run it with the residents that they had. And it was too much. They actually had two programs in what was called the Local Action Plan, which was a plan that revamped San Francisco's juvenile justice system.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
And is she still with us today?
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Bless her heart. So, yeah, so we started in 1998. Huckleberry took over in 2000.
Okay.
Delancey Street came to Huckleberry and asked them if they could take over the programming, because we were probably one of the oldest youth-serving agencies at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And had been doing great work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so we took it over. And I started working there when Delancey Street had started it, a year after they had started it, because of my connections with Delancey Street. So
right.
I was asked to come in and join the team. And so, yeah, Huckleberry started running it in 2000. And we were then seeing like upwards of 650 kids being arrested a year for felonies, misdemeanors, you name it.
For using mostly or for dealing
some
as well,
of them was
for selling?
Some of it was for using, but only when they had it in their possession.
Right.
If there were still some, if it was already in the system, they would take them out to general. To get them cleared.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And is that something that persists? That's a program that persists to this day?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So we've been up now 25 years.
Do you have any idea of the number of people you've helped or
total?
Yeah, any idea? Ballpark.
Wow. When we did
our 20th, what did we?
We did our 20th. Oh, I can't. I just can't. Like seven?
I was going to say 7 to 10,000.
I was going to say it has to be thousands. Yeah.
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 Amazing.
Yeah, and it is an amazing program.
Yeah, and the basic concept is, going back to what I said earlier, mm-hmm. nobody is born a criminal. And so when somebody's arrested, we don't want them to become a criminal because they enter into systems that start to reinforce
that. We all
that.
Know that we'll do that
yes,
to people.
So mm-hmm. let's divert them. Let's connect them to their community church. Let's mm-hmm. see what's mm-hmm. happening at school. Is there challenges at school, then let's talk to the family and see what's going on so that they don't become criminals in the future.
Mm.
And that being arrested is a crisis.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's a crisis for the kid and it's a crisis for the parent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that the last thing that we want is for our kids to go directly into the criminal justice system from the juvenile justice system.
Right.
And so, you know, it's really challenging. Very challenging.
One thing one of you just said, and maybe this will be the last thing we talk about with Huckleberry, and then I've got one thing that I'd like to end on. But I wondered, you must have relationships with schools.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Can you talk about that and the history or how it works or what schools or...
Oh, my God. We've had so many different kind of programmings in the schools. We were doing therapy in the schools for a while at... What, two or three schools?
Middle school, high school, or
high school?
High school.
High school.
Okay.
We were also doing some groups in the Justice School, which is a civic center.
Okay.
We were doing some boys groups inside the school. We do the physicals for young people that need clearance to get back into school,
mm-hmm.
or when they haven't done them and need them done. What else?
In Marin, we have a program that works with the mm-hmm. young people who would be the first in their family to go to college. So these are high school students.
Yeah.
And what we really look at are not the star A students, but...
They don't need help.
Yeah. But those that mm-hmm. are, in situations or in families where they're not getting the information about what does it mean to go to college or what are the requirements even to go into college. Mm-hmm. Over and over again, young people are told, you know, don't worry about it. For you, college isn't for you.
Right.
And we step in and say, it may be.
It could be.
Yeah. And they're telling you, you don't need this class. You need this class. Right. If you want to go to a CSU, you have to take this class. And so some of it's advocating, but a lot of it is just education in terms of what is the opportunity for you.
Meta education.
Exactly. Yes.
I love it.
So in terms of interface with the school, we do a lot of work with Centerville High. We have clinicians there as well doing other things. And in Marin and in San Francisco, we provide a lot of health and reproductive education in the schools. So we're deeply...
I'm getting that vibe.
Yeah. We also have a program called Project Ready,
okay,
which has case managers in two of the middle schools.
Oh.
And they are entrenched in the school to deal with young people that have had delinquency issues or truancy issues. And then we work with them primarily through their entire eighth grade to support them into going into the ninth grade, because we research and data shows that when kids drop out, that's when they're going to drop out, between the eighth and the ninth grade.
Interesting.
So we mentor them. We tutor them. We go into their homes and talk to their families. We have a dedicated therapist. In fact, each one of our programs has a dedicated therapist that works with the young people.
That's so important.
Yeah. We work a lot with the schools.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there anything glaring that I'm missing about Huckleberry that we haven't talked about that you would like to talk about?
I think we work with adolescents primarily, and the transition aged youth, so those are up to age 24.
Okay.
And what we've discovered is that the systems that we're all interfacing with are often not working for everybody at the same level.
They are not perfect.
And so we need to intervene and stop those inconsistencies from happening. And at the core, that's kind of what Huckleberry does. Mm. We believe that everybody has a right to a safe, healthy, just, and educated life. And when that's not happening, adults need to step in and create relationships and partnerships with young people so that it can happen. Most of the time, people come to us not because they're bad kids or not because they are the problem. Mm. Most of the time, they come because of the situations that they've gotten stuck into or forced into or happened to step into. And need a roadmap, need an advocate, need a partner to figure out how to navigate and move forward.
And I have one other thing to say really quickly.
Absolutely.
Is that our pillars of service are health, safety, justice, and education.
I love it.
And we have programs that identify with each one of those, but all of our programs encompass all of them as well.
Beautiful. Okay, the surprise. Every season on our show, we have a theme. This season, the theme is We're All In It. Mm-hmm. I think that I'm going to guess that Huckleberry and you two as individuals relate to that. But what does that mean to you?
So being in it, to me, what I think in terms of Huckleberry Services, I am really thinking about the young people in my life, the young people in my community, and I translate that to the broader San Francisco Marin area and say, these are our young people. These aren't the young people over there. These aren't the people in that other neighborhood. These are the people down the street from us. These are our own kids. And we as a community, as a society, are responsible for raising everybody up in the community. So being in it means being in the community and being engaged with everybody, however they show up. And throwing people away, locking people up is not humane.
It's the antithesis of that.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so whether somebody's unhoused, whether somebody's on the street, whether somebody's high, whether somebody's really challenged at school so they don't go anymore, that's the opportunity for us to step in and engage as opposed to wall off and separate.
Beautiful. Do you have anything to add to that? Or
yes.
Or your own interpretation or your own... What does it mean to you? We're all in it.
It means to me, being in it means disrupting the status quo. You know, I'm a bit of a rabble rouser.
A bit? Just a little bit. Here's a hint. Denise is just a little bit of a rouser too.
And so, you know, I being in it also means pushing back. You know, and being in it means that our kids don't need to be in jail. You know, being in it means that we got to figure out a way how to get our homeless kids off the street. And being in it means educate them appropriately and not virtually. So, yeah, being in it is just whatever it means to support our families, support our kids, support the people of San Francisco into a better way of life.
That was Denise Coleman and Doug Stiles from Huckleberry Youth. On the next episode, we visit Standard Deviant Brewing in the Mission and sit down for a wild chat with co-owner Mark DeVito. Episode 11 drops next Tuesday wherever you get podcasts. Music for Storied San Francisco was produced, performed, and curated by Otis McDonald. Aaron Lim of Bitch Talk Podcast is our contributing producer. And the show is produced and hosted by me, Jeff Hunt. Now in our sixth season, we have more than 200 episodes available on our website, storiedsf.com, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you're able to, please rate and review the show, and drop us a line at storiedsf@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Keep rejecting those silly doom loop narratives about our city. Stay wacky, weird, healthy, and creative. And we'll see you next time on Storied San Francisco. We acknowledge and respect the first humans of the unceded land we call San Francisco, the Ramaytush Ohlone. We condemn the genocide of these and other tribes across the Western Hemisphere. We honor their legacy and history, and we support rematriation and sovereignty efforts.
This podcast is a proud member of the BFF.fm podcast network. Learn more at podcasts.bff.fm.
BFF.fm, best frequencies forever.